Okay. Some more questions. Yeah. I promise you, I don't take this back and look at them and think about what I'm going to answer. It's always much more fun. Just having the questions and just seeing what they are, just answering them on the spot. If you think about things too much, you don't usually get good answers. If you just read the question, allow the answer to come up, you usually get the best answers. And the first question is, when we visit a sick friend and we wish them may be well and happy, is that a blessing? Do fellow Buddhists bless other Buddhists, or is it only monks could do blessings? Thank you. Yeah, because sometimes if you're sick and somebody says to you, may you be well and happy, sometimes that puts pressure on you to sort of do what you're told. So sometimes if someone says, have a good day, sometimes say, sorry, but I've got other plans. That was actually, who was it, some comedian said that. They wished him, have a nice day, and he said, no, I refuse. Because why should we allow other people to tell us what to do? So may you be well and happy. If you're rebellious, you say, no. But the point is, you're saying that with your body, you say, oh, no, I hope that you get well. But if you don't get well, may your mind be well and happy. And of course, you all know that how enlightened beings, when they go and visit a sick friend, what they say, because that's the old story of Ajahn Chah, who came to visit me when I was very sick with typhus fever in hospital. I think I mentioned a few days ago what that was like. It was really weak and felt very terrible. And you can imagine when a famous monk like Ajahn Chah comes to see you, and I was only a baby monk at the time, and he came to visit me, and I thought, oh, so wonderful, the great teacher has come to see me. And I felt really inspired and uplifted until the time when he opened his mouth. Because then what he said, and this is a great way of going to visit like a yogi, someone who's a practitioner. If you go visit them in hospital, you say exactly the same thing which Ajahn Chah said to me. Tell your friend, you'll either get better or you'll die. And then leave. That's true. I'll either get better or I die. There's only two possibilities. Had it happened, I just got better. So when you visit a sick friend, just tell them, you're either going to get better or you die. So don't worry about it, the sickness won't last. It's Adichan. So if it's an ordinary person, you wish them well and happy just to give them support. But if they're really yogi, you say, may your mind be free of the sickness. So your body, it gets better, then it gets sick again, it gets better, sick again. In the end, sickness wins when we die. So you say, may your mind never be sick. So do fellow Buddhists bless other Buddhists, or is it only monks can do blessings? Ah, you can bless anything. That's why I just bless anything these days. I remember seeing this in Perth, they're doing this railway, they're doing a tunnel under the city, having all sorts of trouble with this tunnel. So you know, the unions are going on strike and having all sorts of unexpected problems. So I told one of the engineers who's married to a Thai Buddhist, and he comes to our monastery every Sunday, he said, well, you should have the tunnel blessed. And I said it's like a half a joke, but you know, half seriously. So he went back to his managers of this project and said, I'm going to go bless that tunnel in August. So I bless anything. I bless tunnels, I bless cars. Good fun, blessing things. So you can bless things as well. When you bless things, all it is that you use the power of your mind to wish good energy. And even if there's nothing really there to wish, just the fact that you uplift people's spirits, you give them more confidence. So just give them a little blessing, works. And also you've got the power of the mind. And if you've done a lot of meditation, if you're a good, virtuous person, then your blessings, you'll find they do have power. It's just the power of virtue, and it works. So even like Angulimala. Angulimala's got a special blessing for when women are having a hard time delivering babies. because he'd just been made a monk. He'd just got one of the first stages of enlightenment. And he went on alms round. He saw a woman having trouble giving birth. She was having a beach birth, a beach delivery, and she was in agony. And this was like a serial killer, a murderer. But he felt such compassion for the suffering of this lady that he asked the Buddha straight away, "What should I do?" And the Buddha said, give her a blessing. And the blessing was this, like an activation of truth. Nanguri Mara was supposed to say, "Since my birth, I've never harmed any living being. By the power of this truth, may your baby and you be safe." And Nanguri Mara said, "I can't say that, that's lying. I've killed 999 people." And the Buddha said, "What I meant was, since the time of my birth, in the Aryan tradition as a noble one, I've never harmed any being. By the power of this truth, may you and your baby be well." You can imagine what a powerful saying that was, because that was a serial killer who was now a noble one. And something that powerful, the fact it was a serial killer has now become like an Arya, a noble one. When he said that, the woman's labor, she gave birth almost immediately, her labor pains disappeared. And that became the Anguli Mara protection. And sometimes monks chant that, but it only really works. It really works if you've been a serial killer and now you've changed. Because it's the power of that sort of truth there. But, and I say this as a warning, if you ever want some chanting from the monks, because, especially for women, the reason is because they did some experiments in, I think, Korea, South Korea. And they found out the chickens, I think of every chicken you have in the chicken house, I think they lay an egg maybe once every 8 days or something. But when they listened to Buddhist chanting in this chicken house, they had this continuous Buddhist chanting. And then the chickens laid an egg once every 6 days. The actual chanting made them lay more eggs. So if because of the chanting you have more babies, don't blame the monks, you asked for it. That's only a joke. So blessings actually do work. What's the Buddhist explanation of deja vu? Is it possible for an imagination to be deja vu and vice versa? I guess sometimes the mind is confused over this subject, but the mind is not equipped with such distinguishment. Please advise, thank you. Okay, deja vu experiences. Sometimes, a couple of types of deja vu, sometimes you go to a place because you have lived there before in a previous life. And that sometimes happens. One of my interesting stories about deja vu is, I don't know if anybody knows, there's an English comedian. He's only famous in England, called Roy Hudd. Anyone heard of him? No. He's like a household name for people who watch the TV in England, because he was quite famous when I was young. Roy Hudd, his name was. So quite a famous English comedian. But he wrote this article once. He took a wrong turning while he was going home from the theatre in London. And he went down a road he'd never been to before. And as soon as he went down this road, just literally, he said, the hairs on the back of his head were standing up. He was tingling, electricity. Something really strange was happening. He recognized he had a deja vu experience of this road. He went straight to this house. And many of you, if you've been to London, they have this tradition. If there's been a famous person who's lived in that house, they put a little blue plaque on the wall saying Sir Winston Churchill lived here, or Sir Walter Raleigh lived this place, or Oliver Cromwell, this was his house. And even like modern people as well, famous, like Paul McCartney lived here or whatever. And he went to this house, and there was one of the signs. It was his previous life. Because in his previous life he was also well known. He was a very famous music hall comedian called Dan Leno. And immediately, he saw that sign, he remembered his previous life. And he knocked on the door of this house, and the occupants of the house, they saw him, they remembered him, because he was quite a famous TV personality. So what are you doing here? And he said, look, I've come back to my house. And he explained, this was no joke this time, not a comedian joke, and they were kind enough to allow him to show them around their house. And he'd never been there before. And it was actually fascinating, for because he was actually a famous personality, that was, he was putting his career on the line. You know, as if you're crazy, you're mad by saying things like that. But it was so true that he had to say it, he had to publish it. And the other interesting thing was that how he found out was like a deja vu experience. He went down a wrong street he'd never been to down before in London, and he knew immediately this was where he'd lived before. It's more easy in old cities like London, because they've been around a long time and things don't change. If you try to have a deja vu experience in KL, you probably wouldn't, because your old house has been knocked down a long time ago. But in old cities, things don't change over hundreds of years. And just that plaque on the wall was interesting that, yeah, that actually confirmed. And the other interesting thing was, in his previous life, he'd been one of the most famous comedians and entertainers in music hall, which was very strong about 80, 90 years ago in UK. There was a start of like modern entertainment. It's called music hall. And in this life, he'd also been in the entertainment industry, another sort of comedian, song and dance man. His characteristics from the past had been repeated in this life as well. And he wrote about it. So that's the first part of deja vu experience. Actually, you're visiting a place where you've lived before in a previous life. There are other deja vu experiences where, you know, it's a modern place, a new house or a new city, and there's no way that you could have had a previous life there. It's, you know, it's only very recently. In such cases, very often, it is the fact that people do leave their body, they go travelling around, the old astral travelling, and sometimes you forget about these things, but sometimes you do visit them. You check out where you're going next, and sometimes that those, almost like dreams, you know, what was once a dream, what you sort of forgot about, then you actually, it happens, and you see it. And it's, you know, that place, that time. So yeah, you can have deja vu experiences, which are just because of a little bit of astral travelling at night time. You go to those places, you recognise them. And the third type of deja vu experiences are like real prophecies, where sometimes, especially in dreams, you dream of something and it actually comes true. However, that is quite rare, to actually have a dream which turns out to be true. And one of my friends, he was a monk with me, now he told me that he had a couple of dreams. The first one he had, which was very strange, he kept a recurring dream that in his house, his father was a colonel in the US Army, was quite wealthy, and they lived in Pasadena in this big house with a swimming pool, had a guest house in the back. And he remembered, or he dreamt, that one of his two sisters was playing by the pool, fell in and drowned. It was a great tragedy in the dream. He dreamt it several times. He said one day, being like a young man, 18, 19 years of age, he was, you know, lounging by the pool, doing nothing. And then the dream he'd had very often started to occur. It was that classic deja vu. He saw that and he knew exactly what was going to happen next. He said it was only because he knew what was going to happen next he could be quick enough to save his sister from drowning. He saved her life because of that dream. And of course that really made him very believing in these dreams. But not enough, apparently, because some years later he was in New Zealand, apparently, just hanging around. But he also, like many young people at that time, started getting involved in light drugs, in marijuana. And one day, or sort of several times, he had a dream that the police came to his house and arrested him and deported him. And he said he really kicked himself when that actually happened, because he had all the warnings in the dreams. And one day the police, exactly as the dream said, the police came to the house, they caught him and his friends, and they deported him because he was from the United States. But the third, he said, two out of two came true. He said the third thing, because that he was a monk with me, and it was, what was it, 1972, 73 or something, the Vietnam War was still on, and our monastery was so close to the border of Laos and Cambodia. If you looked at a map, the distance from our monastery to Bangkok was twice the distance to Hanoi. Hannah and I was much, much closer. And for many years, everybody thought the communists would soon invade that part of Thailand. And so it was a very dangerous time. We all had to register with our embassies, and there was an evacuation plan. In case the communist troops came over the border, we were to get out really quickly. But he had always had his dream that the communist troops did actually come over, and he was running across a paddy field when he got shot and killed. And he told me, he said, "Look, I know that's going to happen to me, because two out of two dreams, it came right, exactly what happened. I know that sooner or later, as a monk, the communists are going to come in, and I'm going to be chased across the paddy field and be shot dead." And of course, that never happened. He disrobed and he got killed in a car crash, head-on collision. But that was actually interesting. That was the case there twice. It was absolutely as he dreamed. The third time was completely wrong. That's why these dreams, you cannot trust them. Sometimes they're incredible. They are weird. They're strange. They do come true. But sometimes they don't. And if you want to know about dreaming about lotteries or horse races, you can look at that story in my book about the man who dreamt of the five angels. That's always a really good story, but I won't repeat it here. During sitting meditation, when I relax, my eyes will open. I do not try to shut it, but start to panic when I see people moving, walking in front of me. Should I tell my eyes to close? Thank you. I think somebody actually asked this in the interviews. If you have any little problem like that, anything which disturbs your meditation, you start to become peaceful, and, you know, you do stupid things like open your eyes, what you need to do is keep on doing this programming mindfulness, which is that if you try and do something at that time, your eyes are open, you tell them to shut, you just disturb the whole process. And at that particular time, when you're about to get still and things start to, you know, go wrong, the more you do, the worse it gets. So the only, or the best way of overcoming that, if you've got a problem like that, that at a certain time in the meditation, the eyes open, or you start getting afraid, or you start thinking, whatever, program your mindfulness. At the beginning of the meditation, not at the particular time when it's happening, well beforehand, at the beginning of the meditation, you tell yourself, if my eyes open when I'm peaceful, if my eyes want to open when I'm peaceful, I'll keep them closed. If my eyes want to open at that time, I'll keep them closed. If my eyes want to open at that time, I'll keep them closed. Repeat them three times to yourself. Give clear instructions, so there's no doubt at all. And re-listen to them as you're saying those instructions. And they will be imprinted upon your mindfulness. It's been programmed into your mind. And it's a great way of dealing with problems, because what happens at that time when you would usually, out of habit, open your eyes, the new program comes in and you don't open your eyes, you keep them closed. It's called like an antivirus program for your mind. And it's incredible how well it works. I even teach that to people, say, who are trying to give up smoking. Say, because when you're actually right there, you can't say anything. It's a habit. You just see a cigarette, you pick it up and you put it in your mouth, and before you know it, you're smoking again. Or like reformed alcoholics who are trying to give up drinking. And know sometimes what it's like before they know it, they've sort of already got a few glasses of alcohol in their body again. Because the habits are so strong. So you tell them, program your mindfulness. When I get to that trigger, I see that cigarette, I will not pick it up. When I see that cigarette, I will not pick it up. When I see that cigarette, I will not pick it up. And they tell themselves that, so it's so programmed into their mind. They're listening, they're quiet. And then when usually, they automatically, without thinking, see a cigarette, light it, put it in their mouth, the new program comes up, and they say no. They stop. It just interrupts the pattern, the habit pattern from the past. So whenever you've got any bad habits in life or bad habits in meditation like that, this is a way to stop them. Program your mindfulness. It's very easy to do and highly effective. You have to program that mindfulness, give that suggestion at a time when you're reasonably relaxed, when you can fully listen. Make it very clear what you're telling your mind to do. and also listen when you're saying it. And say it 3 times because that seems to work the best. So if you open your eyes at that particular time, tell yourself, no. Program the mindfulness beforehand. Ajahn, I salute to the flies. It brings out loving kindness to it and to our neighbours, yogis at dining table, through the act of shooing away the flies from the food. Okay, I salute to the flies. You know that's what they call the Australian salute, because there's so many flies. So, and to our neighbour yogis at dining table, through the act of shooing away the flies from the food. Yeah, the flies are just being flies, that's all. It's just, they're looking for a tiny bit of food. And I don't think the flies are all that dirty in Ippo, especially as soon as they come into this temple, because of the power of the loving kindness of the Buddha, any sort of bacteria or defilements on them would probably immediately disappear. So they'd be perfectly healthy flies. They'd be holy flies. And it's true, is it? I think there's been tests done like on the Ganges. For some reason, even though if you've ever been to the Ganges by Benares, there's all these dead bodies floating in it and dead dogs and all the filth from the city goes into the Ganges, but apparently there's no bacteria in that water. And the scientists are quite starmied. They can't understand why. Why can that place, the most dirtiest of water, have no bacteria at all? So all these Indians, they drink it, they bathe in it, and they're fine. So maybe, I know that once, apparently, that just upriver from Benares, they found some relics of the Buddha, and not really knowing what they were, the local Maharaja threw them in the Ganges. And I reckon that's why it's so pure there. Because all the water flows over these relics of the Buddha, which is so pure. So all these flies are flying into this holy temple. So I'm sure that they can carry no bacteria. So they'd be perfectly okay, even if they walk all over your food. Dear Ajahn, why do some people meditate with crystals around them? Do the crystals help in our meditation? Thank you. I don't know either, but I know it's good business. So you don't need to have crystals, but some people believe in them, and if they believe in them, maybe it works. So a lot of time it's a power of belief. If you believe they work, they do work. If you don't believe they work, they probably won't. So maybe it's just a power of faith. I don't think there's anything inherent in those crystals to help them work or not. Dear Ajahn Brahm, if this meditation can help bring out the psychic powers in a normal person, how about those who are naturally gifted with psychic power? Will meditation manifest their powers more many folds? Yeah, obviously they'll enhance it. That's why sometimes people who do have some sort of gift sometimes want to learn meditation to actually to enhance and channel those gifts. But what's really important with any psychic powers, you have to keep your precepts. You have to be a good person, a virtuous person. We mentioned, I think, yesterday or the day before, Devadatta, who got some psychic powers and then tried to kill the Buddha. But as soon as he started to have that pride and that ill will towards the Buddha or towards anyone, he lost all his psychic powers almost immediately. So there is like a fail-safe mechanism that if you lose your virtue, you also lose your psychic powers. You have to keep virtue. And it's happened in several occasions. You have some yogis or gurus or monks, but they start off with their psychic powers. But if they haven't got the virtue and the wisdom, sometimes they get proud, and sometimes they use their psychic powers for material gain, to make money or to become famous. As soon as you start doing that, you start losing your psychic powers. And it's happened that sometimes you get these TV documentaries which expose them for cheating. And it's almost certain that those people were, they originally started out with real psychic powers, but because of pride or ego or making money, because they misused them because of bad virtue, then they lose their psychic powers. But because of their reputation, they try and fake the powers. That seems to be what happens. But if a psychic knows of a fatal event causing death or accident, someone, a fatal death or accident to someone, can the other person be warned? Changing the path of fate may have its consequence on the psychic? No. It's just like kindness, compassion. You see something about to happen, sometimes you know there's no way of stopping it. The karma is so strong. There was an interesting case some years ago in a town to the south of West Australia called Albany. There was a guy fishing on a famous cliff, and a freak wave came along, a king wave came along, like many tens of meters high, washed him off the cliff and into the ocean. And usually that happens every few years, they have these king waves, and usually obviously people die, they drown. But it just so happened there was a fishing boat close by. They happened to see that. The fishing boat rushed as fast as he could to get this guy. The fisherman jumped in the water and just so heroically saved his life. And of course it was in the papers. This fisherman was a hero. And this guy fishing was so lucky that someone actually saved his life. But about 2 weeks later, the guy whose life was saved died in a head-on collision in a car. That's the one going to the newspapers again. It's almost like he had to die, and there was some mistake made that someone saved his life, and they shouldn't have done. But then sort of karma came back, and you know, he was meant to die. So if you do, you can't, if it's really meant to be, you can't change it. But nevertheless, sometimes it's worth trying, just out of kindness and compassion. So if a psychic knows a fatal event, sometimes they try and tell them, stop them. But often, just the person won't listen. So that's one of the problems. People who are psychic like that, they feel they have this huge responsibility. And sometimes they'd rather not be able to do these things. They just want to be normal. You tell them, just be kind, be compassionate, and realize you won't be able to save everybody's life or change very much at all. But if you can, give it a go. Next question. If we dedicate our merits to this deceased loved one, can she receive it in her new rebirth? If the deceased is still seen, does it mean she hasn't been reborn but still in bond and bardo? Why is she still around us? Okay, the usual way we share our merits is to have all sentient beings, all our relations rather than one particular one. When it's all our relations, there's always somebody there who can receive our merits. And if you give to everybody, it's not like sort of giving a cake where they always have to have a portion and divide it, so the more you give it to, the less they have. When you share merits, everybody gets the same. In fact, if you've got such a big heart, you give it to everybody, everyone gets more. So that's why we usually dedicate our merits to all my relations, or usually I do, to all sentient beings. You can't get bigger than all sentient beings. But even if you really want to focus on one particular loved one and they have already been reborn, sometimes they can feel it. Remember I was saying the other day about the relationship, if you and your sort of father or your daughter or whatever, if they are injured or sick, you know. Or if they feel really happy, you feel their happiness as well. There's always that connection between the people we've lived with. And that connection goes beyond the grave and it goes into the next life, especially the first few years of the life. So if you have a deceased, say, aunt who's died and is now a young baby girl or boy, and you share merits, yeah, they will feel it. But the longer they live in this life, the more that connection to you gets weakened. So if it's many years ago and they've been living in the human realm for a long time, they'll only receive a tiny fraction of what you sent. But if a deceased is still seen, does it mean they haven't been reborn but still in the ghost realm? Yeah. Sometimes that people do get seen for a certain time, so if you're psychic you can see them hanging around. Or sometimes you might see them in your dreams. Again, if you just see them in the dreams once, it's just remembering just a dear loved one. But if you continue to see them repeatedly over many days, then it's quite likely that they are trying to contact you, which means they usually haven't been reborn. But sometimes that they may have been reborn in the Deva realm. You might see your loved one as this beautiful being, clothed in white, radiant or whatever. And that's a sign they're doing really well. So it's only if you actually see them like in a ghost realm floating around your house, or you see them in dreams and they're sort of really hungry and they're needing something, that's a sign they're in the ghost realm. And if they're still around you, it means that they want something, they want some help. Sometimes if it's another type of ghost, it means they just like you. They want to hang around, just look after you. And I heard this wonderful story about the dog ghost. There's in Perth, there's all sorts of nice ghost stories. I don't know if I told this in KL, I think I told it in Singapore some time ago. There's this woman in Perth who lived by herself, but she had a dog. And her dog was, you know, like, not just a pet, it was like her child. And they went everywhere together. You know, like some people, they sometimes, you know, they're fed up with having a husband. They have a dog instead, they're much easier to look after. So this lady had a dog. And one day she was going on a walk in the park or the forest with the dog, and she lost one of her finger rings. And it was a very sort of special ring, which and had a lot of meaning to her. And they looked all in the park for this finger ring, but when you lose something that small, and there's grass and twigs and leaves all over the place, it's almost impossible to find. So having looked around for an hour, she gave up and went home. And a couple of days later, the dog died. And so she forgot all about her finger ring. She was just devastated that the dog, which was her companion, had passed away. So she did a little service for it and buried the dog. But after the death, she swore that she heard the dog barking in her house. And if you've got a dog which has been with you for such a long time, you know the sound of your dog's bark. It's completely different to any other dog. You can recognize it. Just the same way that, you know, you can recognize my voice, you can recognize other people's voice because you're so familiar with them. So she could hear the dog barking, you know, for the next few days. It's the ghost of the dog was in the house. And she was absolutely convinced when one day she heard the dog barking outside the door of her house, very, very loudly. So she opened the door. There's no dog there. But right on the little mat where you wipe your feet as you go in the house, in the middle, was her finger ring. The ghost dog had found her finger ring and brought it back and left it on the mat outside the door, woof, 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 so she could open the door and get her finger ring back. Like a true modern ghost story of the ghost dog who couldn't do much else for the master or mistress, which the dog loved, but got her finger ring back. Isn't that a nice story? And a true one, too. Ajahn Brahm, is it alright for one to meditate in one's bedroom? Yeah, sure. However, if you meditate in your bedroom, meditate a long way away from your pillow. Because pillows are magnetic. There's a force which draws the head to the pillow. So you can meditate in the bedroom, but don't meditate on the bed. Otherwise, you'll find you're doing what I call meditating flat out, which means sleeping. And also, if you do lying down meditation, like I think someone asked that the other day, lie down in a position where you don't normally sleep. So you can see, like on there, on the piano there, there's a picture of the Buddha lying down meditating in the lion's pose. You can see that that's not how you go to sleep, lying down like that. In fact, your arm will just get so sore if you go to sleep like that. So it just what it does, it tells the body, psychologically, this is not the way I sleep. This is not the time to sleep. And if you do that, then you don't fall asleep, but you can actually rest the body lying down. It's a very lovely posture, but it's not in a position, the same position you go to sleep. So usually, that's a very difficult posture to hold for a long time. If you go to sleep on your side, then meditate on your back. If you go to sleep on your back, then meditate on your side. Something different, so that the mind knows this is not the time to sleep, this is the time for meditation. And don't do it on your bed, because your mind gets very confused. The body's on the bed. You want me to go to sleep, don't you? So now I want you to meditate, but everything tells the mind it's sleep time. So remember those cues and that psychology of the mind. Put yourself in a position or in a place which is not the normal time or place you go to sleep. And then the body will be awake. Dante, while meditating a peaceful state of mind, fear arose. What should we do? It's marvelous when fear arises in meditation. It means you're getting close to an attachment. Every time you get afraid in meditation, there's something which you're not willing to let go of. And this is what meditation is supposed to be about, uprooting those attachments. So ever you get fear coming up and say, whoopee, great, this is an interesting part of my meditation. So instead of running away from the fear, go up to the fear. Find out what you're afraid of. What are you afraid of losing? What are you afraid of disappearing? And you'll find there's something there. For example, when you get afraid when your hands disappear, what's wrong with that? Because you think that maybe I can't control my hands, you know, when I don't know what's going on. Maybe I can't protect them. It's always this controlling and protecting business. So when I can't think, I can't think, I'm going to go crazy or some devil's going to come in my mind. That never happens. Devils only come into your mind when you are thinking. They make you think evil thoughts. But when you're silent, devils and demons can't do anything. They hate it when you're quiet. So it's you don't need to be afraid of these things. And when you get this powerful nimitta, sometimes the reason why we feel afraid, we think, this is too strong, I can't control this, I can't handle this. Again, it's always controlling things. So a lot of the fear is about fear of losing control. And that's what you're supposed to do in meditation. It's great fun to lose control in meditation. That's why some people are afraid of their emotions. Sometimes you're afraid of crying because you think you're losing control. And you are. Congratulations, that's what we're supposed to do. Let go. Let go of controlling. So allow your mind just to let go. Now you know that some people in the world are afraid of falling in love because they think, they're going to lose all control. But falling in love you do, and it's not such a good idea. But when you actually get into deep meditation, everything is just fine. So if you're in a peaceful state of mind and fear arises, great. Stay there and find out what's going on. You're on the edge of great insights. And when you find out where that fear is coming from and why, you face up to it and you unlock it, and you usually go straight into a deeper state of meditation. And it's so wonderful. So when fear comes, don't run away. Go right up to it. Find out what's going on, what you're attached to. Unattach, the fear goes and gets so peaceful. 2. Can we be in a jhana state without a nimitta? It is possible to get into a jhana without a nimitta, without going through the nimittas, but it is just too unreliable. 99% of the time it's not a jhana. That's why the nimittas are by far the best path, because you know exactly where you are. You've got more idea to handle the entrance into the nimittas to find out what's going on. So I really, really encourage the nimitta status, especially the light nimittas. When you say can be in a jhana state without the nimitta, you should go through feeling nimittas instead of light nimittas. In other words, the nimitta is being experienced as if it was a physical touch rather than a light seen with the mind's eye. However, it's usually much better to do the light nimittas. So it's possible, but it's not advisable. 3. When we're in jhana stage, how do we feel? We feel peaceful and our attitude changes. In the jhana stage, you feel completely blissed out. It's a super state. That's why the Buddha called them Uttari Manusadhamma. Literally means superhuman states. Above the normal human consciousness. So this is not a normal experience. This is intense. This is amazing. This is wonderful. This is blows you up, blows your mind, as they used to say. So those incredible experiences, not normal. So sometimes people come along and say, oh, I just got jhana today. I say, what? So I just did a jhana today. I say, no way. I say, ah, the jhana, whoa. If they get all excited, I know there's more chance there was a jhana. But if it's just like they just had a cup of tea or they had some nice noodles today or they just watched a movie, then if there's not so this like, emotional and exciting response afterwards, no, this is not really a jhana. The jhana is even spinning. These are incredible stages of the mind. So they really do affect you. Yes, about attachment. When we concern about a person, is there any link to attachment? Okay, there's. If it is a selfless, if you really want the other person to be happy and well, it really is metta, then that's what love is. But attachment is something different. And for example, in my book, I gave people like a test to find out if they really love their partner with loving kindness or they love their partner with attachment. And the test goes like this. You know, for those of you who've got a partner at home, you've left them for 9 days, and then you go home. Imagine this scenario. When you go home, there's a letter waiting for you. And they say, your husband, your wife, whichever gender you are, your partner, leads you the letter saying, I've run away with your best friend to say to Phuket, I'm having a wonderful time, I've fallen in love with your best friend, signed, you know, your dear husband, or your dear wife. What would you feel if you find that while you're on this retreat, your partner of so many years, your wife, your husband, has run away to Phuket with your best friend to have a steamy weekend? How do you feel? If your love was really loving kindness, you'd feel so happy that they're having such a wonderful time. Because all throughout this retreat you say, may my partner be well and happy. May they have having a good time. And they're having a much better time with your best friend than with you. Now that is a sign that you really do love them. That it's a selfless love. But if you think, that dirty rotten scoundrel, that's my best friend, how can they do this to me? Then that is attachment. So if it really is loving kindness, it's selfless. You don't care about yourself. You just want the other person to be happy. Just matters of, I don't care, just want you all to be happy and well and enlightened. So if you have like loving kindness for your friend who's on this retreat, say, may you be well and happy, and you find they become enlightened before you. It's not fair. This is their first retreat. I've been coming to these places year after year after year. I've given all these donations. I've kept the 5 precepts. This is the first time they've kept any precepts. It's unfair. I complain. Then that's not loving kindness anymore, is it? Jealousy. So you can understand the difference between attachment and sort of loving kindness. If someone comes here for the first time, you've been meditating all your life, and they become fully enlightened in the first day, you think, oh, isn't that wonderful, isn't that inspiring? So amazing. And you really feel like that. No jealousy. This is called non-attachment. So that's the difference between ordinary love and non-attachment. Dear Ajahn Brahm, my grandmother recently passed away peacefully. Due to heart failure, at 99 years and 6 months, that's really good. She has been a vegetarian since her 40s when she lived at Kuan Yin Temple assisting in daily chores. I know her to be a very pious, kind-hearted and compassionate faithful devotee of Kuan Yin and the Buddha. The days of her death, a god auntie, her adopted daughter, consulted an uncle who is a medium who frequently goes into trance and was told my grandmother had been reborn in the Deva realm. How accurate can these findings be? And is there a way I can find out by myself through meditation? For a person to be born into a deva realm, does it happen immediately upon death or after the customary 49 human days? It's so hard to find out for yourself. The only real way to find out for certain is for you to die yourself and go and find out. But that's not recommended on this retreat. And sometimes in deep meditation, if you've got the divine eye, which is incredibly hard to do, then maybe you may be able to find out. But even then, sort of, now sometimes these psychic powers, which even monks can develop, you know, through deep meditation over many years, sometimes there's always a little bit of unreliability to them. And sometimes you say, yeah, it seems that way, but it's never absolutely sure. So because of that, that even if the medium says, you know, you can't actually be absolutely 100% sure the medium's got it right. However, that if your mum has, you know, been a Buddhist and gone to the temple, assisted in daily chores, a pious, kind-hearted, compassionate, faithful devotee of Kuan Yin the Buddha, if you say that and that's true, I think that can give you certainty. Anyone who's lived such a good life is bound to go to the Deva realm. So that is the best way of finding out, by looking at their lifestyle. And if they lived a kind, good life, it has to be the case. They go to some Deva realm. And is it after 49 days or just immediately? It really depends on when she wants to go. Sometimes, if you're 99 years of age, you've already let go of most of your attachments to your family, and you know, you've been there, done that, so you just basically say bye-bye and go straight away. But sometimes, you know what happens, if you're very attached or people are very attached to you, it's like when you send someone to the airport, you know, if you know you keep travelling very often, they just take to the airport, bye-bye, you check in, you go straight through. But if you've got lots of friends and devotees, they've got to give you a breakfast, they've got to give you a cup of tea, they've got to talk to you, have to have the photograph, it takes forever actually to get into the departure gate. So that's the same, that, you know, if it's like a loved one, it takes 49 days, you know, being in the airport, having checked in. Now you checked in for your new life, but you've got to say goodbye to everybody. You have to be at a little funeral service and make sure everything's done okay. So 49 days, and the 49 days is the last boarding call you have to go through. So that's basically what it is. So a 99-year-old, they usually just, they go straight through. They don't linger around. It's usually, you know, just the middle-aged ones or the young ones. They usually have to linger around, make sure everything's done okay, because they're attachments, and then last boarding call, the last moment. Only then do they go in. Okay, next question. Dear Ajahn, with regard to the third precept, many monks do not explain it clearly. Do prostitution, premarital sex, and gay relationships constitute a breach of the third precept? Okay, the third precept is the Kamesa Micharchara, which is usually translated quite accurately as like sexual misconduct. We don't actually say exactly what sexual misconduct is, because actually, in truth, that's one of the precepts which actually changes from state to state and from time to time. It's not a precept which is the same at all places and all times. It's very much what your society or your time and place considers to be misconduct or not. And if you follow the letter of the law, which is explained in the suttas, it's an interesting one, this, because if you follow the letter, only men can break that precept. Women can't. Because it defines it. It defines it as saying, like a man goes with another person's wife, or they go with like an underage girl. And the underage girl depends upon our society. They're always changing the age of sexual consent. Or they go with like a prisoner or a servant or someone, a girl who's mentally deficient. It's always about men having relationships with girls. And if you look carefully, follow the letter of the law, there's nothing about girls having relationships with men. So I tell the girls, you don't have to keep that precept because it's not defined for you. But that's only the letter of the law. Obviously, it also means the same the other way around. So adultery is certainly breaking that precept. So, if you have a husband and you sleep with somebody else, that's breaking your precepts. And these days, because, you know, we have what's called de facto relationships, you know, you're living with somebody and you're basically as husband and wife, it's the same for those as well. If you have that committed relationship and you have sexual relations outside that relationship, then that too is breaking your precepts. When it comes to gay relationships, again, there's nothing in the suttas which say that's wrong. And the same would apply to a gay relationship. If say two men or two women are in a committed relationship together, and they break the trust of that relationship by having sexual relationships with somebody else, not their partner, then they're breaking the precepts. But if they keep their relationships within that commitment, with that sort of man and man or woman and woman, then that's not breaking their precepts. As far as prostitution is concerned, if you are a man and you've got a wife and you go with a prostitute, obviously that is breaking your precepts. However, there's one very interesting example where that wasn't breaking the precepts. This actually was from the early years as a monk. One of the leading figures in the local village and one of our main supporters was the headmaster of the local school. And once a week he used to go to the brothel, and everybody, because he was an important person, they'd always jeer at him because he was the headmaster of the school. And headmasters are supposed to be people with high moral standards. And when, I think it was Ajahn Sumedho tried to reprimand him and say, you know, you shouldn't do this, you're the headmaster. And then he explained why he was doing this and why he talked to Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn Chah said, okay. Because his wife was actually mentally unstable. She would, in all other cases, she'd be in an institution. She could not look after herself. She couldn't cook or clean the house. I don't know what actually happened to her, but when they married, and she was an ordinary girl, but something happened, some disease or something, accident, and she became like mentally unstable. And you know, with all of his duties of looking after the children and being a headmaster of the school, he looked after her with all her needs, cooking and cleaning and washing her and bathing her. Just so kind. But he was a man, he said, look, I need my sexual relations. My wife is completely unable to supply those. And so that's why that he went to the brothel once a week. And when I heard that, and Ajahn Sumedho said, you can't argue with that. That's an extreme case. Where there is a man, he's got a wife, but his wife, because of the disease, which is going to be there forever, is unable to satisfy his sexual needs. So he said, that's one of those cases. It's not breaking the precepts at all for him. But otherwise, yeah, it does break the precepts. But be careful. That is a precept which some men find it very hard to keep. And sometimes he's a good Buddhist. And the reason why is because, you know that lust makes you crazy. In other words, that if you see a woman, it may be in your office or just a friend, that sometimes that once you start to have lust, you forget everything which is right and wrong. You do literally go out of your mind. And you only see one thing. So if you get to that stage of lust, it's completely crazy. And that's why that afterwards you think, what the hell have I done? My goodness, I've cheated on my wife. At the time you can't see the faults. Be careful, like lust is a disease which drives you crazy. And you lose all sense of right and wrong. So because of that, if you have a wife already, you're committed, if you start to see yourself getting attracted to another girl, remember, look for her pimples, as I said last night. Or remember, it's all dead stuff on the outside. Because you too have to now protect yourself. The same with women as well. You might see some sort of really hotcake monk men or something and think, whoa, I'd like to have, be with him. But be careful if you carry on that idea for too long. Sometimes it drives you crazy as well. And you do stupid things, which you always regret afterwards. So if you see any man which you really like, and you're already committed, you've got a partner already, sort of walk away or develop a super meditation to see the faults so that you can actually subdue that lust. Because once lust gets you, it's like completely crazy. And drives you insane sometimes. Just mad things. Yeah? Single man involved with a married woman, a single woman involved with a married man, it's huge karma there. And it is a problem there. It's bad karma for the single person, as well as the married person, having a relationship outside their their commitment. For the single person, you're breaking up a marriage. So, you know, if you have like a married person, they're still married, if they're divorced, or even if they're, you know, in separation, you know, the marriage is obviously finished then. There's no hope of it coming together again. And maybe the, you know, the formalities, I don't know what the laws are for divorce in Malaysia and how long it takes. But if that divorce hasn't really happened yet, it's best to hold off. But you know, if you know there's no hope that the relationship has broken up, then it's fair enough. It's, you know, the person is free, they're not committed anymore. But if they're still married and you have a relationship with them, you're just really asking for a lot of trouble. It is bad karma. And you should know that. Just the amount of times, that just the suffering which people get when their marriages break down, and how devastated they are in divorce, and the problems which the children have to face. It's just really not worth it. And there is, you know, women, men, there's so many other good men, good women around. So, you know, choose one which is appropriate and free. Don't go sort of choosing one which is committed to another relationship. You're just causing so much pain and suffering. And that's bad karma. So if you see a married man, keep your eyes off. And certainly keep your hands off as well. Same with seeing a married woman as well. It's just not worth it. You get a little bit of happiness, but a huge amount of suffering afterwards. So that's what the third precept's about. It's not just trying to stop people from being happy, it's actually to enhance their happiness so they don't get into trouble and get into these terrible dangers. Anyway, yeah, self-indulgence, I can't really see the problem there, but if you're, you know, married, you know, your partner should be you know, the one who satisfies your needs, not yourself. But self-indulgence, I can't see too much problem there, except that, you know, it can become too much of a habit. If it's just because your partner's away for a while, can't see any problem there at all. You know, because sometimes if it's male or female, sometimes those energies are a bit too strong. You've got to acknowledge those sexual energies and adjust them accordingly. But be careful you don't encourage those sexual energies too much. Because sometimes people do go crazy. Now, next question. Someone mentioned on letting go to me to submit. Someone mentioned on letting go and total surrender earlier. Appreciate if Ajahn could also address these two components of giving up. Are they experienced the same mental state, i.e. peace, calmness and blissful encounter? Thank you. May be well and happy. Okay, letting go and surrender. Usually surrender is surrender to another being or to another thing. Whereas letting go is just almost like opening up to emptiness. The other being or the other thing is not really there. And especially under hypnosis, you actually do surrender to that other person and you allow them to control your mind. And allowing other people to control your mind is always a very, very dangerous thing to do. So letting go is not allowing anyone to control your mind, but it's actually letting go of all control whatsoever. So surrender is usually surrender to something else's control. Well, letting go is no control at all. Neither controlling nor being controlled. Then that's usually the best. And certainly it's the safest. How does one cultivate contentment in daily worldly life? Is living within one's mean one of the ways? Okay, you've got to be careful of contentment in your daily life. Because you have to strive. It's your duty to work hard for your partner and for your children and your family, for your country. So I made that point. When I talk about contentment, this is what you do when you're resting, when you're meditating, when you're taking time out, when you're in Club Med. So my favorite saying is, when there's nothing to do, then do nothing. Be content. When there's something to do, give everything you've got. If I was really content in my daily life, I would never have arrived here at Ippo. I have to have some discontent, some wanting, some planning to get here in the first place. So all the success in building monasteries or whatever is always because you're doing something. But when it comes to meditating, that's when I give up, I content. So I work, I travel on my journey. When it's time to rest and smell the roses, it doesn't matter how far I've got, doesn't matter how much work needs to be done, how much of the journey is in front of me, I don't care. Now is rest time. Now I am content. When I start the journey again and struggle through life, then I work. So being content is not something you do every moment of your day. If you do that, you never even go to the toilet. So you'd be content to let go of your burden right here on the mat, which would be a stupid thing to do, disgusting as well. That was actually what I thought. I thought, first of all, an enlightened person has no desire. Have you ever heard that one before? No desire at all. I thought, how would an enlightened being go to the toilet? It's actually to get to the toilet, you have to have a desire to go there. So it's obviously wrong. Enlightened beings have desire. But it's called loving kindness, compassion, right thing to do, duties. But that's what you do when you're not meditating. When you're meditating, you're completely content. This is a time of no desire. But when you're working, give everything you've got. While concentrating on the knowing of the in and out of the breath, I tried to let go of the feeling of the body. As I did this, my body, my arms, fingers, limbs, legs, toes, etc., become numb, and after a while I feel good. Is this what it's like? Yeah. Because the numbness is the beginning, and then it disappears. There's nothing there anymore. And you feel so good and peaceful about having a body. And it's great when your body disappears, but don't ever be afraid. You're sitting there and you can't feel anything. No heat, no cold, no tiredness, no mosquitoes, no flies. The flies can be all over you, but you just don't feel them. Isn't that wonderful to be free of this body? Imagine, is there a difference between never mind, let it go, and I don't care attitude? If you don't care, you would never let go. So you care for your happiness and peace. So actually letting go is caring. If you don't care, just your old habits keep on. You never get anywhere. So you do care. You care for your peace, you care for your tranquility. So it's let it go. It's the ultimate care. The caring for yourself. How can one sleep with mindfulness and wake up with mindfulness? What is it to sleep with mindfulness? I thought if we sleep we will not be aware of what we are doing anymore. Absolutely correct. That is a famous and gross mistranslation of the Satipatthana Sutta. I don't know why. I pointed out to many people, they have in the Satipatthana Sutta, you are mindful when walking, when sitting, when lying down, when standing. And then they say, when sleeping and when awake. And sometimes, actually, they translate that as well, going asleep. That actually means mindful of sleeping. What does that mean? Because you can't be mindful while you are in sleep. In that Satipatthana Sutta, what it means is you're not mindful in that moment, you're mindful that you slept. Mindfulness is not always in the moment, sometimes it's a mindfulness of recollection. In the same way that after a jhana you recollect what those days were. The Satipatthana means you recollect, you slept, and why you slept. What was the purpose of it? So when you actually go to sleep, you can be mindful up to a certain point, and then your mindfulness turns off. And then you wake up in the morning, you're mindful again. So during the sleep, it is impossible to be aware. If you're aware, you're not asleep. So this is what one can do. But what it means by being mindful as you go to sleep, instead of just allowing yourself to think about anything, it's great actually to do some letting go just before you go to sleep. Just present moment awareness, silence, just let go. No future, no past. Then you go into very, very calm and deep sleep. If you can't do that, do loving kindness to yourself. Dear me, I've been meditating all day. I really worked hard. I'm tired now. Now's the time for me to go to sleep. May I sleep well, may I sleep happy. Pleasant dreams, me. Good night. This is the same as if you were tucking your baby in bed at night. There you are. You can even tell yourself a little story. And then after the story, good night, and give yourself a kiss. Good night. That's called giving yourself loving kindness before you go to sleep. And it works. The Buddha said if you give yourself loving kindness before you go to sleep, you always sleep well, you're protected, you never have any bad dreams, and you wake up with energy. So any of you who are really dozy when you get up in the morning, when the even before the, you know what it's like being in the dormitory, there's always these smart alecks who like to get up at 3 o'clock or 2:30. Don't they know that I need my sleep? It's all right for them, but and then you sort of wake up just feeling really awful, and that's a rotten way to start the day. So don't do that. Give yourself this nice loving kindness, and when you wake up, you have loving kindness. And when somebody gets up early, they wake up. Oh, isn't that wonderful? That nice lady, she's getting up so early to meditate. Well done. And because you're so kind, say, oh, but me, I need a bit more time. So you just turn over and you go to sleep again. So be kind to yourself. So you go to sleep with kindness, you wake up with kindness. So, I think you've heard me say this before, the last person I say goodnight to before I go to sleep is me. Good night, me. Have a nice night. And when the first person I say good morning to is me again. When I wake up, here I am again. Good morning, me. Have a nice day. Hope you give some nice talks today. So, say good morning to yourself when you wake up. And wish yourself well. Please explain the meaning of bliss that one can experience in meditation. If possible, give similes. Oh, my goodness. The bliss of meditation exceeds all other blisses. The only similes which I've given so far, and because I was not born a monk, I was sexually active before I became a monk, is actually sexual orgasm, or just falling in love. The incredible bliss of happiness. The sexual orgasm is just like pleasure. With falling in love, it's something romantic. It feels so wonderful and so high. Just imagine multiplying that 1,000 times. And you get some idea. And that's having actually last for hours. So you have some idea of the ecstasy of meditation. Some of a huge pleasure which just stays. It doesn't go anywhere. It's just there, just having fun all this time. No wonder you're wrapped and you're peaceful and you can't come out. It is so emotionally fulfilling. So like multiply falling in love, sexual ecstasy by 1,000 times. And you get some idea of what meditation is like. You interested? Of course you are. And afterwards you say, Ajahn Brahm, you were right. When we are doing walking meditation, is the mind that notes the right step the same as the mind that notes the left step, or are they different? Are the minds which note eye, ear, nose and tongue the same or not? Thanks. When sense contact arises, how does the mind react? A very profound question. The answer is every mind is different. I'll maybe mention that tonight when I go into the non-self talk, and I've got the old simile of the fruit salad, which I'll tell you this evening. But that actually, when you actually see that the every mind moment is completely unique and different, if you can actually see that, then you know that this thing you call consciousness is fragmentary. It's not this continual process of awareness. I'll give this to you again tonight, but it's like a beach. If you look at a beach, then sometimes you think it's a continual stretch of sand. Like if you look at this conscious flow, you think it's a continuous flow of mind knowing. But when you get closer, you find every of the sand is made out of particles, little grains of sand. Individual pieces. And that's what happens when you look more closely at consciousness. You find the individual moments of consciousness. It's only when we don't look closely enough we think it's a continuous flow. It is granular. And if you look even closer, there's actually a gap. No two grains of sand, even though they're adjacent, are touching. It's a gap between them. You see there's moments when the consciousness just turns off and stops. Where even consciousness, where even knowing ceases before it turns on again. So every mind is actually different. But to see that, if you do see that fully, that's going to make you a streamer at least. It's a great question. Please don't go on, because I'm not getting through these questions. Does anyone put any more questions in there? You're not supposed to put any more questions in, so I'm trying to finish them. So the old questions, my goodness. I read in a book that tells in one mind there are three kinds of mindfulness. There's initial mindfulness, middle mindfulness, and end mindfulness. Wherever they are all arise, the thinking mind and the knowing will immediately separate. Please explain. That sounds a bit like convoluted to me. Only in every moment is only one mindfulness of now. So beginning, middle, and end, I think it's all muddle mindfulness, not middle mindfulness. So there's only mindfulness in the moment. I don't know who wrote that book, it doesn't make sense to me. Devotion, in the practice towards enlightenment, we are transforming our consciousness into wisdom. This is pure consciousness, total cease, when an arahant enters parinibbana, yes. Everything ceases when the arahant enters parinibbana. That's why it's called aparisesa nibbana, nibbana with nothing remaining. And you think, wow, that's unfair. I've worked so hard to become enlightened. Do you mean I can't enjoy it now I'm there? And the answer is yes. Vasudhi Magas says it really wonderfully. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Nirvana is, but not the one who enters. And to find out more of what that means, this evening, everything will be explained with no self. Ajahn, to be mindful, do we have to slow down in all our activities or just go at our normal pace? Go at your normal pace. If your normal pace happens to be slow, fine. If your normal pace happens to be fast, fine. So you're just not controlling, that's all. I know that some people, they do this walking meditation, they get to this really slow walking, which is fine. Except when you leave here and you have to cross the road to get to your car. And this traffic is waiting forever for you to cut across the road. So be normal. How do we feel our breath? Is it a particular spot or just a general feeling? Again, it is any spot. And in fact, the best spot is no spot at all, just so you know the breath. You just ask the child, are you breathing in or breathing out? The child will tell you. They don't have to notice that at a particular spot, wherever it happens to be. The problem when you try and watch it at a particular spot, sometimes the breath doesn't happen to be there. It should be there, you think, but it's not. Therefore, you can't find the breath. It's like my simile saying that sometimes today, somebody will be going down to Bodhidharma Monastery in Perth looking for Ajahn Brahm. That's where I should be, but I'm not there, so they can't find me there. It's just like you can't find the breath. Why can't you find the breath or Ajahn Brahm? Because you're looking in the wrong place. I'm in Ipo. So if they want to find Ajahn Brahm, you have to come to where Ajahn Brahm is, then you'll find him. If you want to find the breath, go to where the breath is. It's not always in the same place. It moves around. So just ask, where is my breath? How do I know? Then you'll find it. You have to be like a spy, like one of the secret police. Who's following a terrorist suspect. This person may be holding a bomb. Maybe they may be innocent, but you've got the job of training them. Wherever they go, you have to follow. Even if they're a man, they go into female toilets, you have to follow them there. They're not supposed to be there, but your job is to follow them wherever they go. And that's the job you have to do with the breath. Even if it's not supposed to go to your ear, you go there. How can the breath be in this ear? But someone's already done that meditation here. They said, yeah, they understand it can happen. Even the breath, it's impossible it's at its ear, but it is at your ear, so watch it there. Doesn't matter where the breath is, that's where you watch it. It's just like a secret police following the suspect. You never let it out of your sight. What is the difference between trying to be in the present moment and being in the present moment? If you're trying, you're trying to get something in the future. And actually you can't be in the present moment if you're trying anything. So to be is to stop. Just to exist. Stop going somewhere. Instead just be. And that's the difference. Do a couple more, otherwise I get into trouble tomorrow. Ajahn, when an imitator is stable, does it become translucent or stay bright? Thank you. If it does become translucent or whatever, it becomes beautifully translucent. If it's bright, it's incredibly bright. If an image is stable, it just grows and grows and grows. Be patient. If it's not growing, it means you're expecting something. There's some wanting going on there. You're stopping the process. And that's where we look at attachments. We use a bit of insight there. If the nimitta is stable, but nothing else seems to be happening, it seems to be staying the same after 5 or 10 minutes, why? You're actually trying to control it. A lot of the time you're expecting something to happen. So skip up all expectations, just be completely content. You got this far, this is good enough. And in that contentment, you come closer to the present moment, and then the nimitta starts to really explode in light. Ajahn, when a person attains the jhanas, are they assured of not being born into woeful states again? Not necessarily, but your chances are increasing enormously of being reborn in the good realms. So it's still possible, but unlikely, that you'll be reborn in the woeful realms. How does one's karma influence when one can go into jhanas and the frequent length of the jhana states? Your karma, especially if you've got a beautiful mind, you've been generous, virtuous, selfless, your mind becomes so powerful, so beautiful, so pure. But when I was saying about the five senses and the mind just gets so powerful, even an ordinary sense experience, people see the nimittas. So maybe eating their meal, you've got this big nimitta in front of them. They're just driving their cars on a big nimitta in front of them. Sometimes their mind is so still and so pure and powerful, the nimitta is almost there all the time. That's because your mind gets so powerful, so intense. That's because your good karma can get to that degree. But for most people, your good karma is so wonderful, you've got an incredible pure mind, so happy, so delightful, you just let calm the senses a little bit and your nimitta comes up, because your mind is that strong and powerful. Yeah? They can sit with the eyes open as well. Sometimes that happens. Because the mind is so strong, you've got the five senses, you've got the sixth sense, with your eyes open, the nimitta is so strong, the mind is overwhelms it. So, you know, you're going around, this big light in front of you. But all you need then is just close your eyes any time, wham, bam, and you're really flying. Because the mind is so strong. That's only extreme cases of incredibly strong-minded people. No, because you've got so much power, you know exactly what to do. So you're not really a zombie. Your mindful is incredibly powerful and strong. So if you just tell the mind, no, just go and do your eating or your sweeping, then it'll do it. The mind will be that powerful, it can see the nimitta and see everything else as well. You can do the two things. Your mind is extremely powerful in those stages. Yeah? What? Hours, days. Yeah? The eyes are open, you feel vibration, but that's still physical feeling, and that's pity coming up. Pity is like the joy which comes in the still mind. Sorry to ask this, but how did the doctors declare a great meditator like Ajahn Chah died? The doctors just said that he had water on the brain which caused brain damage. And I forget exactly what the final decaying of the brain causes death. But the doctors, don't care what doctors say, the monks said this because, you know, even great masters had some karma from the past. Just like Mahamoggallana, one of the chief monks of the Buddha, was beaten to death. And that's how he died. He didn't have like a peaceful death, even though he was fully enlightened, a great monk. And that was because from a previous life, he actually killed his parents. And that's really heavy karma. And because of that, many, many lives previously, because of that, he had to, in his last life, had to be beaten to death. So even great monks sometimes have past karma for many, many lives. Most of the karma, you know, you can overcome, but the heavy karma, like killing your husband, your father or your mother, that's so heavy, even in an enlightened being, you still have to get some recourse for that. There is Gautama the Buddha, there are Bodhisattvas, there are Arahats, there are monks which people call living Buddhas. They are all enlightened beings. But what is the distinction? Okay, if an enlightened being, the Arahats or the Buddhas, it's just Buddhas were the first Arahats. When we come to enlightenment, I'll answer this question again, because it's an interesting answer, that if anybody, say if you become a Sakadagami, a once returner, which means in your next human life you become fully enlightened, then if you manage to take birth at a time when there's other Buddhas around, or when there's the Dhamma is still strong, then you'll become an Arahant, fully enlightened. This is your last life. But there's Buddhism around, there's teachings around. That's the distinction, you'll be called an Arahant. If you're a Sakadagami, you become enlightened at a time when there's no Buddhism left at all. Then once you're enlightened, if you don't teach, you become the Jaka Buddha. If you once returner, and you get reborn at a time there's no Dhamma around, you become enlightened because this is your last life, and you decide to teach, then you are a Buddha. A Buddha is an Arahant who starts the teaching. That's the only distinction. How can we tell if events happen due to karma or due to other factors? Sometimes you can't. Some things are due to karma, sometimes other things. But you can actually say, like a tsunami, did everyone who died in that tsunami, did it die because of some past karma? You say, well, you can't really say because they killed their parents or whatever, they drowned their maid or something, they had to die. But what you can say, they had the karma to be reborn as a human being, and once you're a human being, you can die at any time. In the same way that man in Thailand went to see Ajahn Chah, he was being joined the army, he had been wounded in a battle, he went to complain, why me, I've had bad luck, I've been wounded. And Ajahn Chah, what do you expect, you're a soldier. That's what happens when you become a soldier. You shoot bullets at other people shoot bullets at you. Some of those bullets are going to hit. What do you expect? Stop complaining. And it's the same with people who die with, like, in tsunami. What do you expect? People die of all sorts of things. And sometimes that's going to be your relation who dies of a tsunami, or sort of, you know, something, you know, falls from the sky on top of their head. It's par for the course. You should have looked at the small print before you took birth. It's right down there. Taking birth as a human being, you can die any time, tsunamis, heart attacks, car accidents, at any time. It's called par for the course. So before you get reborn next time, have a look at the small print and you see in there, can die of tsunami. Last question before, because it's half past, I should carry on. If nimitta is a sign of a mind, what is seeing the nimitta? It is a mind seeing itself. The simile which I gave was like you looking in a mirror. So this particular event, it mirrors the mind. So you're literally looking at yourself in a mirror. The mind is looking in a mirror at itself. If a person lost all his or her five sense organs, can he or she see the nimitta always? That's a really, really good question. If someone lost their five sense organs, they would die. In other words, they really couldn't see, hear, smell, taste or touch. The reason for having a body is completely gone. And so the body would just turn off and die. So you get reborn. And when you get reborn, the mind actually can make its own sense organs after death. So it's hard to lose all your five sense organs. When you lose it at death, now, when I say the out-of-the-body experience, you have like mind-made sense organs for a little while, so you can see and hear, but through the mind. And when those sort of fade away after a little while, that's when you see the nimitta. But very often the five sense organs get recreated again, and that's one of the problems. But if you did lose all your five sense organs, you'd be reborn in the jhana realms. And there, you don't see the nimitta all the time, this experience of bliss all the time. Okay, I think that's enough. I didn't get through them all, but it's 9:30 now. And we've got interviews. So, these questions for tomorrow. You can still add a few more in there because there's only a few left from today. So hopefully you enjoyed some of those questions. Maybe at this time of retreat, I'm going to start making a rule. And that is, one yogi, one question. Because sometimes you look at these and you recognize the writing. So there's three or four questions in there for the same person. So that takes a while. And when I say one question for one yogi, I mean not sort of part one, part two, part three, part four. Just one yogi, one question. So make sure you know what your question is going to be and put it down in the box. And if you think later on, no, I've got a much better question, you've got to search out your own question, take that out and put in your new one. Okay, so one yogi, one question per day. No more, otherwise we'll never finish. Okay, very good. Okay, so sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And now you can have the interviews done for that.